Are we protecting those who protected us during the most difficult days of the pandemic? From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Tuesday, May 25th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we talk trauma and frontline healthcare workers. How is the pandemic going to impact some nurses and doctors in the days ahead? We talk about important parallels between these professionals and combat veterans, including isolation, personal risk, and the impact of valorization. We unpack how a traumatic experience or series of experiences can impact brain health. Then we head to Warner, South Dakota, to meet a cattleman who has created a life by design. We preview the 2021 Festival of Cultures in Sioux Falls, and we amplify the voices of local musicians later in the hour. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. A federal judge in Aberdeen will decide whether three members of the U.S. Marshals Service should be found in civil contempt over his requirement to have everyone in his courtroom vaccinated for the coronavirus. Judge Charles Kornman notified courthouse employees in March that the vaccinations would be required to provide the safest environment for everyone. The U.S. Marshal for South Dakota, Daniel Mosteller, responded to the judge, telling him the U.S. Marshals Service is not requiring employees to get the vaccine and that they will not provide their vaccination status to the court. Mosteller, the Chief Deputy Marshal, and Chief of Staff for the Marshals Service have been ordered to appear at a hearing on June 14th. Two South Dakota penitentiary inmates convicted of robbery and burglary are asking for a new trial. Lawyers for the inmates told the state Supreme Court Monday that they should have been able to tell the jury about the victim's status as an illegal resident and how he might have a reason to lie about the crime. Victoria Wicks has more on this appeal for SDPB.
Both Ariana Reese and Kevin Dickerson were convicted of robbery and burglary, and Dickerson was also found guilty of aggravated assault. The convictions resulted from an incident in late 2019 when the two entered the Sioux Falls apartment of Julio Gomez Rojas. When his neighbors heard him screaming for help, they called the police. During proceedings leading up to the trial, Reese and Dickerson said they should be able to tell the jury that Gomez Rojas, an illegal resident, might have a better chance at getting a visa as a crime victim cooperating with prosecution. After a hearing, the trial judge found that the information would more likely prejudice jurors against the victim than help them in reaching a verdict. Both defendants now appeal their guilty verdicts, saying they were denied due process. At oral arguments, Kevin Dickerson is represented by Minnehaha Public Defender Christopher Miles.
Dickerson's trial attorney told the circuit court, credibility will be a central issue in this case. And the prosecutor told the jury, really it comes down to one question, who do you believe?
Miles says in a battle of credibility, the defendant should have been able to tell the jury that Gomez Rojas had a motive to lie because his status as a crime victim could help him get a visa. Defendants also appeal the judge's permitting a bank statement into evidence when a proper foundation had not been laid. Assistant Attorney General Aaron Hanke says the case did not revolve only on credibility.
There was evidence in addition to Gomez Rojas' testimony to corroborate what he said. So, for instance, the screaming that the neighbors heard of him being all bloodied and bruised from being hit with a gun.
Hanke says the defendants were able to fully confront and cross-examine Gomez Rojas. Justices will deliberate and issue an opinion at a later date. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Victoria Wicks.
Sioux Falls Christian is celebrating its first boys' tennis state championship. The Chargers won the team title last week in Class A. In the AA boys' class, Sioux Falls Lincoln won its seventh straight title. The Patriots scored a dominating 561 team points, which was 120 more than second-place Sioux Falls, Washington. For weather today, we're seeing a wind advisory in effect for much of the north that will last until later this evening. Today's highs are in the upper 60s in the west to the mid-80s in the southeast. That's going to cool down a bit tonight with lows in the upper 30s northwest to the lower 50s in the southeast. Mostly clear skies statewide tonight. For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Lori Walsh, a lawyer who previously ran a black metal label that included anti-Semitic and white supremacist music, is trying again to be admitted to the South Dakota Bar. Aaron Wayne Davis made his pitch to the South Dakota Supreme Court Monday. Davis tried for admission in 2019, but the Supreme Court rejected that application. Victoria Wicks has more of this story for SDPB.
In August 2017, City Pages published an article featuring Aaron Wayne Davis, an intellectual property lawyer in Minneapolis who also ran Behold Barbarity Records. The label offered music with violently anti-Semitic and racist lyrics and merchandise with neo-Nazi symbolism. The article noted Davis also organized an annual satanic music festival in Chicago and that the Southern Poverty Law Center listed Behold Barbarity as an active hate group. After the article came out, Davis was dropped by the law firm where he worked. Other publications took up the story, including the ABA Law Journal and Billboard Magazine. Now Davis is 47 years old and says he lives in Custer with his wife and two toddlers. He tells the state Supreme Court that he has practiced law for 18 years with a spotless disciplinary record.
The only complaint I've had was generally related to the subject of a City Pages article that was published in August of 2017. That complaint was promptly dismissed by the Minnesota Board of Law Examiners shortly after it was made, stating that no laws or any ethical rules had been broken.
Davis says he represents clients without applying any personal biases. He says he has Jewish clients who stayed with him even after he told them about the City Pages article and will soon represent them before the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. He says he regrets that his past music sales have undercut his life's mission to help all people in need.
And I've shown that over the course of decades by helping people in sobriety, helping people on a pro bono basis in my work, and I've represented him on a paying basis, every conceivable color, creed, religion of every person that's out there.
Davis says just a small percentage of the music he sold was offensive.
I greatly regret the fact that I put myself into this position by selling merchandise, however small of amount as it was, and not taking a closer look at that before it was sold.
Davis says he has never personally attacked anyone for racial or religious reasons. He says he has maintained sobriety for years and sponsors others. He had a kidney transplant last fall, and he assists his family, which he says is racially mixed.
I'm not burning crosses and going to, rallies and things like that. I'm living I never have done anything like that. I live a very family-oriented life, and that's the way I'd like to keep it.
Davis says these factors prove he is of good character to practice law in South Dakota. Justices will deliberate and release their decision at a later date. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City.
You can find more news stories online at sdpb.org/news. Ahead on In the Moment, Trauma and Biological Injury, SDPB's Jackie Hendry talks with Dr. Matt Stanley. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Across the country, Republican-led state legislatures are trying to restrict how teachers talk about race in their classrooms.
It puts fear in our teachers that what if they say the wrong thing? What if somebody in their class during the critical thinking brings up the word oppressor or oppression or systemic racism? And are they in danger? Is their job in danger?
I'm Elsa Chang. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen, beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Cultural Heritage Center in Pierre. The museum now offers free admission to South Dakota residents and children from everywhere. Coronavirus protections in place. More at 773-3458 or history.sd.gov.
Hi, it's Julie Rose, host of Top of Mind. Memorial Day marks the traditional beginning of summer. It's also a time to revere sacrifices made by others so that we can enjoy our freedoms. My team has put together a special hour featuring conversations about legacies and memorials. We'll learn about projects to collect soldiers' letters and to preserve veterans' memories. I hope you'll join us.
Listen Memorial Day at noon Central, 11 Mountain, and 7 Central, 6 Mountain, here on SDPB.
Underwriting SDPB Radio enhances your corporate image and projects quality and credibility. Stand out from the competition and reach a quality audience. Include SDPB Radio in your branding campaign, sdpb.org/support. Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and we're focusing on trauma today and post-traumatic stress. In a few minutes, we're going to ask some tough questions about South Dakota's frontline healthcare workers and the impact of their pandemic experience on their mental health. But first, SDPB's Jackie Hendry sat down with Avera Health Vice President Matt Stanley. They talk frankly here about the risks of having access to firearms during a mental health crisis. It's a key conversation in South Dakota where gun ownership is valued and common. But we begin where Jackie asks Dr. Stanley to help us understand post-traumatic stress and those things that we might not realize about trauma.
It doesn't always have to be something that happened to you. It can be something that happened to a loved one or something that even you heard about that greatly affected you, usually because it involved a loved one. So we look for that moment of trauma, that intense stress, and there's usually a physiologic response at the time, so elevated heart rate, elevated pulse. And we know to some degree that those kind of immediate physiologic responses have an impact on later development of post-traumatic stress. But who will and who won't develop post-traumatic stress from an event is a little harder to divine and can be based on several variables. So just because you're exposed to a stress doesn't automatically imply that you're going to need help or that you're going to develop a problem. But the things to look for if you've been exposed, there's several areas, and so I think it helps to maybe just break them down into those. So one of the most common things, and in fact one of the requirements from us to diagnosis, is some form of re-experiencing the trauma. So the most common kind of thing we hear in common conversations is flashbacks. People will describe the intensity of the event, like I'm reliving it, sometimes to the point where they almost lose track of what's going on around them. They feel like they're back in the event. But it can also be things like dreams. There can be triggers, like a certain smell or a certain noise, and it will remind you of that. And you may even get the physiological responses you had, at least to a degree. And that's another component of it, that kind of heightened arousal. So this is where we talk about people who have this incredible startle reflex. Maybe they are awakened in the middle of the night to shouting and then gunshots and then someone is harmed. So they will, be relaxing, hear someone shout, and they'll just, it will startle them. They'll jump, we talk about hypervigilant, always scanning the environment, never able to relax, very tense body posture. So that's that arousal part. And then there is, some impairment in functioning. So people find themselves with more difficulty to focus or concentrate. They're more irritable, more angry, more quick to anger, or have more mood swings. To the point where, you can feel hopeless, depressed, suicidal, all of these things, in constellation create the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress. So it may not even look exactly the same in each individual, but these components are common to the illness.
Mm-hmm. At what point, if someone recognizes some of those symptoms, at what point is it appropriate to seek kind of professional help in managing some of that?
I think the earlier the better in general. And as I said, just because you experience a distressing event doesn't mean you're going to have it. But if you start having that hyperarousal or those, flashbacks or dreams or re-experiencing the event, I would say any of those, even if it's just mood, because even if you don't experience post-traumatic stress, you might develop complicated grief. And even if it's just someone to talk you through the difference and help you to understand where you're at, So much of what we need to do when we meet with people who are struggling with new emotions and dealing with, you know, their new reality of their world, so much is just to put it into perspective and tell them this is normal, this is concerning. But it's hard to do that without a navigator. It's hard, it's really hard for us to assess ourselves. And I think for those of us in the behavioral health field, we have the context of seeing hundreds, if not thousands, of people who've gone through different things. And aside from our training, we've just seen it. And I think it becomes far easier for us to, even if you don't require treatment, to just advise.
Shifting gears, I've also seen, and I'm not sure if this matches with what you see, that in reality, if someone is dealing with a mental illness, they're more likely to hurt themselves than to hurt other people. Both nationwide and in South Dakota, 50% of suicide deaths are completed with the use of a firearm. How does a person's access to firearms impact the work that you and others do when working with someone in a mental health crisis?
Just from a statistical standpoint, if you have a firearm in your home, you have about a 3-time greater risk of dying by suicide, just by owning a firearm in your home. And I want to be clear at the start of this that I'm a gun owner, I'm someone who enjoys hunts and family activities that actually kind of revolve around that, but I'm a tremendous believer in the importance of gun safety. You know, the number of people who die by their own hand with a firearm is more than twice that die through homicide every single year. I mean, that's not an aberration, that's every year. It's twice as many kill themselves as ever are harmed by a firearm. So both are unacceptable, but I mean, if you want to look at raw numbers, the number of people who are killing themselves with their handguns is the bigger concern just from a number perspective. So one of the things that we know is very important in trying to protect someone with suicidal ideation is to secure the guns in the home or secure access to the guns. Because another thing that's a little bit of a misunderstanding by some about suicide is that it always kind of follows this linear path to get to a certain point of action and then it stays there. The reality of, as we study suicide, is it waxes and wanes, peaks and valleys. It's often a relatively impulsive action. In fact, there's, I think the number's 45 attempted suicides for everyone that's completed. The problem is with firearms, it's 90%. The last statistic I saw, which even that seems a little low, 90% if you attempt suicide by a firearm, there is no second chance. It's only 4% by every other means. So, yeah, just take a look. I mean, that is just like your eyes are saying, that's a compelling, those are compelling statistics. So the other thing we know about these attempted suicides is most don't go on to end their life by suicide. So you have a 4% chance against a 90% chance. If you can just remove that firearm, remove that opportunity to make an irredeemable choice 90% of the time, we think you've significantly improved your opportunity to survive whatever you're going through. I think, you know, and you look at the demographics, it's men far more likely to commit suicide by firearm than women, which, although men attempt suicide less than women, but the numbers of men who commit suicide are greater just because their means, it's their choice, is the most lethal type of suicide. So again, no second chance, no opportunity to reconsider.
It's SDPP's Jackie Hendry speaking there with Dr. Matt Stanley. He is a psychiatrist and he's clinical vice president with the Behavioral Health Service Line and with Avera Medical Group University Psychiatry Associates. We're going to talk more about post-traumatic stress in just a few moments, but this time we're focusing on our nurses and our doctors and healthcare workers. How did the pandemic impact their mental health, and what's the role of a society in protecting those who strive to protect us?
And as always, the state of South Dakota has numerous resources for talking about and preventing suicide. Go to sdsuicidepreventionorg online, or you can call 24 hours a day, 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. You're in the moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In the 1 year since George Floyd was killed, states like Washington are taking a new approach to teaching police recruits about racism and policing.
So it's embedded within the curriculum, and hopefully that viewing of it by recruits who are coming through allows it to be seen as something that is not taboo.
That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Humanities Council, celebrating literature, promoting civil conversation, and telling the stories that define our state. Learn more at sdhumanities.org.
Great question. That is a great question.
And that's a great question.
Wow, that's another great question.
That's a great question.
Oh, that's a great that's a great question.
That is a great question.
What a great question.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear unexpected questions and unexpected answers. This afternoon at 2, 1 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by Sanford Underground Research Facility, supporting South Dakota teachers and students with classroom resources, field trips, and professional development. Learn more at sanfordlab.org.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, we call them heroes, we applaud their efforts, but frontline healthcare workers saw and continue to see the very worst moments of the pandemic. The job is far from over. Today, we're talking about the result of that stress and some important parallels between frontline healthcare workers and combat veterans. Our guest is Harvard-educated trauma expert Shauna Springer. She's affectionately known in the veteran community as Doc Springer. Her latest book is called Warrior. Doc Springer, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for making time for South Dakota.
Thanks, Lori. It's good to be here.
To get our listeners who don't know your work very well yet, tell us, to get them up to speed, tell us a little bit about your work with the veteran community. How extensive has your interest and your education and experience to things like post-traumatic stress? How deep does that run?
Sure. So I have been really serving the tribe for over 10 years now in the trenches of mental warfare. I'm the chief psychologist for Stella, and we are advancing innovative options for post-traumatic stress across the country. We have about 20 treatment sites. And I've written, as you said, a book called Warrior that just re-released. And it has a bunch of insights that I've learned from my partnerships and healing relationships with so many warriors over more than 10 years.
Yeah. Is this new information, new treatments that are coming out that maybe we didn't know, say, in the Vietnam era or even the Gulf War era?
Very much so. Very much so. What we now know is that post-traumatic stress is not an invisible injury, that you can see it on the brain scan if you have the right scanner, and that a healed brain looks different from an injured brain. And so we now have neuroscience-based treatments that are available to really treat the injury of post-traumatic stress. So these were not available when our Vietnam warriors were coming home from war.
Let's talk about our frontline healthcare workers now, our nurses, our doctors, the people who were dealing with the very worst days of the pandemic, sometimes losing multiple patients per day and then going home. You say there are some really important parallels between that experience and the experience of a combat veteran. Where do you want to begin with that?
There are, yes, as you put it, striking parallels between the two. The people that serve on the front lines of this war, of COVID, are the warriors for today's war. And they are people that are wired in many ways, like warriors, that they are calm in a chaotic situation, that they can do things that most of us can't do. They also have to make impossible choices with very limited information, and they see traumas that they will never forget. In addition, they have guilt over those they can't save. Warriors, the worst feeling for a warrior is feeling helpless. And so if you work as an ER doc, you know you might lose a couple a week, but losing 30 a day for several days at a time is an entirely different thing. So the conditions that they're facing are very similar, and I could expound further on that, how they are similar to conditions in a war zone for many of our combat medics.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the separation, because when we think about military service, we often think about a deployment. You're going to go into a theater. These people were largely in their home communities, although many healthcare providers did travel, but they were still separated in some ways. What have you seen that is a parallel there?
That's such an important point. So healthcare workers that have been fighting against COVID have been burdened by the knowledge that their families are impacted by their absence. And they have essentially been separated from their families, many of them, you know, living near the hospitals where they're working and working long hours and late shifts, and then protecting their families by staying at a distance. And so they are making these sacrifices that few people are perhaps aware of. And they know that their partners, their families, their kids, their elderly parents are all experiencing anxiety during the time when they are separated from them. So it's a tremendous sacrifice they're making for all of us.
You mentioned, you know, kind of being wired for calm or trained for calm. Say if you've, you know, you're an ER doc or you're a nurse who specializes in emergency care. Many of these providers, because they were pulling from so many different areas, maybe were wired for a different kind of healthcare service and kind of called into action. So I want to talk a little bit about training. And my experience in the military during Operation Desert Shield was that so many military people were sent off to the Middle East without the equipment that they needed, without mop suits and without gas masks. And they just kind of got on the plane and went. You know, they didn't have a flak jacket. Maybe they'll get one when they deploy. Maybe they won't. They had been trained sort of override that, you know, that switch of self-preservation. Are our healthcare workers trained the same way to override that? Because they also were asked to do things without proper protective gear. We had healthcare workers who were, you know, improvising, reusing, adapting, and overcoming in a way that perhaps nobody expected. What can you tell me about that?
I think we didn't protect them. I think a wise society protects those who protect us. And it's a very important parallel that, you know, when you go into a new situation, in some part, it's understandable because you don't know what the threat is going to look like. And so there is this period of chaos. I know when we first went into Iraq, we didn't have the right kind of equipment, in part because we were trying to learn as we go. But once we learn the shape of the threat, then it really becomes important to provide those who fight our wars with the proper protective equipment, with up-armored vehicles and body armor and all the things that we know can preserve their life. And I feel like we didn't do that very well with so many of our medical providers and those, to your point, who were not trained as ER docs. And that was not really their wiring, but they got retasked in a kind of all hands on deck way to face this fight. And maybe they weren't set up or trained to do that role, but they stepped up anyway. And so another really important parallel with our military community, whether they've been deployed or not, is that they serve under an oath of something greater than themselves. And our medical providers have stepped up for us and served us and protected us and supported us and have done that at great personal sacrifice. And they have seen that as a mission that's bigger than themselves. I mean, what if they said all of a sudden one day, this doesn't really work very well for me and my family, or I don't like working under these conditions, and they all walked off the job en masse. But that didn't happen. And that, to me, speaks to a kind of warriorship of their own that shows up in the health profession that I think is really important for us to consider and protect.
for people who are listening and say, well, you know, we applauded them. We hung hearts in our window. We sewed masks when we thought we could drop them off at the local hospital. But then for healthcare providers in South Dakota, just for context, South Dakota never had a universal mandatory mask, guidance from the state of South Dakota. Some municipalities did, many businesses did, but there wasn't one collective decision that we're all going to wear masks, for example, or we're all going to have capacity regulations. So many of these providers went to work and then driving home or driving to the place that they were staying, whether it was a hotel or wherever, it drove by bars that had, you know, people outside, you know, gathered without masks, and they could see immediately the disconnect. So I want to talk a little bit when you said, you know, protecting the people who protect us. I think on behalf of nurses and doctors here, they were able to see very clearly that not everybody was on board with some of the things that the healthcare providers were asking people to do. What kind of impact can that have?
Right. Well, it's, you know, there's a huge disconnect, you know, and so it was a very similar parallel to people saying, you know, thank you for your service to our military service members, but not actually doing anything that requires real sacrifice of themselves to really join with them and bring them home from the war. In the same way, I talked to healthcare providers who were at the front lines of COVID when the surges were happening, and they said it was a punch in the gut to see people congregating and working out in groups during a time when they were living in this nightmare of a situation with the horrors of multiple deaths a day playing out. And they were so frustrated by this disconnect of a kind of, you know, hero worship on the one hand, which isn't always helpful, actually, because it makes people feel like they have to be strong and they can't be fully human. But there was also this piece about, do people not understand that their choices and their sacrifices or lack thereof directly fuel the deaths in the ERs? So it was really a very challenging thing. And that trauma is going to have a very long tail. I think there is a bit of a broken trust now between healthcare providers and the American public in a way that there has been for some years now with the warfighters and the people that we send to deployments for whether they're in war zones or not.
Yeah, you mentioned hero worship, and I think a lot about valorization or the over-valorization of veterans. Say more about this as we move into some actionable steps or how we can be supportive as we look at that long tail and what happens next. And not everybody in healthcare is going to be impacted in the same way, because everybody came in with their own set point, their own previous trauma, their own mental health issues, you know, beforehand. There's lots we don't know. But as we look forward, what does it mean for those people to go ahead and be fully human instead of just held up as the nation's healthcare heroes? If you know somebody who is in this profession, where do you begin?
Yeah, so, you know, we often talk about people being heroes or being resilient. And there's a dark side to that, because the more you tell somebody that they're resilient, the more you sort of put them into a corner where they feel like they have to always be strong. And if they don't feel resilient inside, if they are really suffering and struggling inside, and you keep calling out how much of a hero they are, or how resilient they are, it actually moves them farther away from getting the help that they need. So one of the things, you know, here we're coming up on Memorial Day, and that is not a day, you know, about, it's not Veterans Day, it's not the same thing. It's a day of grief. It's a day of remembering those who have fallen. And it's a day of listening for longer than feels comfortable. And so one of the things we can really do if we want to support our healthcare workers, our warfighters, our National Guard, who is tasked to casualty, to find bodies of people in houses that had died due to COVID or suicide or other causes, tremendous trauma there, is that we can open our homes and pull together people and give them a safe space to share whatever they want to share in whatever detail they want to share it, and then respect their need to have space with the people in their tribe as well that go through the same experiences, because that connection, when we connect, we survive. And so making space for that entrusted relationships, that is the antidote to much of the trauma that people are going to be experiencing and the break in trust that we've seen with our healthcare workers and many within the American population.
How important is it to have some kind of navigator or professional be part of some of those conversations? Especially I'm thinking now of how much of South Dakota is rural, and many of these people were tasked with caring for neighbors who they knew, friends and neighbor, family members. If you know you live in a small town, that is who you're treating, and that is who you have lost. So many of us have connections with people who were diagnosed or died from COVID-19. When do you know that it's time to bring someone else into that conversation who is professional?
Yeah, a trusted doc can really be a game changer in terms of helping people to understand their trauma and grow through their trauma. Part of my urgency right now with everything we do at Stella and everything I'm kind of working with is to scale insights that will help people move through their trauma, because there is such a gap in terms of what is needed. And to your point, it's really a different thing to say, I feel guilty over those who can't be saved. And I know those who can't be saved. They were in my community. I had a personal relationship with them, and I had to hold their hand as they passed away with nobody else around, and I knew that person. That's a whole other level of trauma. And so there's going to be so much trauma. And the good thing, I suppose, is that telehealth is much more available than it has been, so people can fit that into their lives. But there will still be a gap in terms of not enough mental health providers for all of the people that have needs. So we're going to have to innovate like our lives depend on it, because I think they do in this next phase of things.
Hmm. You mentioned a long tail. And again, I want to bring it back to that conversation about veterans, that the things that we don't know now, you might move on to the next normal now, 5 years from now, 5 months from now, 10 years from now, you might start having symptoms or evidence that there is, you know, a biological injury that you haven't quite dealt with. Talk a little bit about how long this can take to really fully reveal itself, and how are there things we can do now to prevent that kind of delayed response and treatment?
Yeah, well, a couple of really important points there is that trauma does split your life into two parts. And one of the things it can take from us is a sense of being part of a community, because it changes the nature of how we perceive our relationships, how we navigate the world around us, from a sense of what could go wrong or dread or anxiety or threat, as opposed to feeling neutral or wanting to approach things. And as you said, there can be a delayed response. So another parallel between healthcare workers and military service members is they are very good at compartmentalizing. And then that can pile up and really hit all at once, sometimes substantially after a trauma. I've seen this play out with all kinds of traumas. One of the things that people can do is, to your point, understand that there is a biological injury that is part of the trauma response. So if you start to have feelings like you can't sleep, you get sudden surges of irritability that seem to come from nowhere, you get flooded with panic that doesn't seem related to your situation, you have difficulties all of a sudden concentrating, you're constantly hypervigilant, or you're jumpy. Those are those biological symptoms of a trauma response. And there are treatments, stellate ganglion block is one of them, but there are also other treatments now available that can really help people to get calm in their own bodies, because trauma can take that from us. And then in combination with therapy, working with a trusted doc and really processing all of the trauma and the thoughts and the patterns of thinking and behavior, we can really get a long-term outcome. So my message is really that post-traumatic stress happens to all of us, not just one particular group. It's a human universal, but it's not a life sentence. There are now effective treatments we can have that can really help give our lives back and get us long-lasting positive outcomes, and I've seen them.
Doc Springer has been my guest. The name, full name there, Shauna Springer. You can find her online at docshaunaspringer.com. We'll put a link up on our website as well, but you can go directly there if you want. Shauna is spelled S-H-A-U-N-A. Doc Springer, this is fascinating. We really hope to have you on the program in the future, but thank you so much today for your time.
Thank you, Lori.
Let's take a moment now and head to Warner, South Dakota. It's in the northern part of the state near Aberdeen. Larry Schroeschein is a cattleman and a storyteller. From his kitchen table, the third-generation Warner cattle producer shares a bit about his farm's history and his passion for raising cattle. Now, as you listen, you might hear SDPP reporter Laura Rohde as she types in the background.
But I can remember one time Dad and Grandpa talking, and I think it was 1928. Grandpa had a tremendous wheat crop, and there was three magazines, farm magazines, that he had a subscription to, and they all told in there to hold your wheat. It's going to go to $3 a bushel, and that is pie in the sky. So then in 1945, while Mom and Dad were renting different farms, and this one came up for sale, so then Dad bought the home plates back in the fall of 1945. Always had cattle. Well, I guess you can buy your bull that you like from somebody and match them up with your cows. And then you take the heifers from the bull that you picked out with your cows, and you pick out the best heifers you like. And then you keep those for cows, and then you match them with another bull. And pretty soon the herd becomes part of you because you basically made it the way you wanted it to be. Most farmers, when they retire, they buy a boat. And they go out and they fill their cooler full of beer, and they go out in the middle of a lake, and they fish with their beer cooler. Well, I fill my beer cooler full of beer and put it on my Polaris and go out in the middle of my cows, and I sit there and drink beer and have the little calves schnoozle on my fingers. And then when I come home, I don't have to clean fish.
That is Larry Schroeschein. In his own words, the word of the day is schnoozle. Now, from the culture of cattle country to the Ellis Island of the Prairie, we journey next to the city of Sioux Falls, and we check in on the people who gather to celebrate a global experience. You're in the moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Jackie Hendry, host of South Dakota Focus. The Sovereign Bodies Institute reports 173 missing or murdered Indigenous women in our state. Most of those cases remain unsolved. We hear stories from the Capitol Building in Pierre, where loved ones gather to call for justice. Plus, a visit to the only long-term shelter for human trafficking victims in South Dakota. That and more, Thursday night at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB-TV.
Program funding by Denny Menholt, Rushmore Honda in Rapid City. Inviting you to experience the peace of mind and more that come with driving a certified vehicle from Denny Menholt, Rushmore Honda. See you at Denny Menholt, Rushmore Honda, Rapid City.
I am pleased to announce that SDPB has been awarded 9 Regional Edward R. Murrow Awards for our reporting in 2020. Winning categories include writing, video, features, sports, investigative reporting, continuing coverage, and the Overall Excellence Award. Your support makes it possible. Thank you for your partnership as we tell South Dakota stories. Award-winning reporting is what you have come to expect and what we continue to strive for at SDPB.
Program funding by First Dakota National Bank. Every timeless institution, tradition, and thriving business was started somewhere by someone who had a dream. Here's to those who made it happen first. FirstDakota.com/first.
Diversity and Minority Affairs reporting on SDPB is supported by Rapid City Rotary Club and the family of Dr. Ashok Kumar.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. The annual Festival of Cultures returns to Sioux Falls after a pause for the pandemic in 2020. Explore sights, sounds, and tastes from around the world on June 12th at Falls Park. Joining us now for a preview, we have Carla Thibar, Development Director for the Multicultural Center, and Nishat Taznim, Interpreting Services Coordinator for that same center. Carla, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. We're so excited.
Nishat, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Carla, start by telling us a little bit about, you know, how this year has been for the Multicultural Center and, you know, some of the work that you're coming back to post the height of the pandemic, we hope, so far.
Yeah, so we've actually remained pretty busy through the pandemic. We do have 21 programs and services here, and so one of our largest programs is our after-school program, which when schools closed last spring, we were able to do kind of an outreach method of academic recovery and assisting kiddos with their homework and their education through dropping off packets and making phone calls. And then we also have our job skills program, which helps immigrants and refugees find employment here in Sioux Falls. And we had to change how we met with people, but we definitely kept meeting with people for that. Nishat could tell you more about our interpreting services. She's been busy with that, which has been quite a busy program here.
Yeah.
Yes, Nishat, go ahead. Yeah.
So the interpreting service last year was very busier than the normal. We had interpreters going, working with Sanford and Avera at the emergency rooms and also like COVID sites where the testing sites were going on. We had multiple languages translation for community outreach about vaccines, about testing site, about COVID in general. So yeah, it's been a very busy year for us with interpreting. Mm.
One of the things that is so key about the Multicultural Center, as you mentioned, all these programs happen that people don't normally see, but the Festival of Cultures is the very visual representation of all the different, people from around the world and places that people have called home before they made their home here. Tell me, Nishat, we'll start with you, about bringing the Festival of Cultures back after a year of hiatus.
We are so excited. We definitely have missed it last year. So we have workshops planned this year, which is very new, which we haven't done in the past. There will be soccer. There is like Irish dance workshops. We have entertainment listed as hula hoop dancers. I'm sure Carla will be able to tell more about the entertainment lineups. We have ethnic foods with bunch of varieties with Guatemalan. There is going to be gyros, Liberians. So yeah, we are really excited to welcome it back again.
Carla, add to that the sights, the smells, the colors, the sounds, the taste. It all comes together
Absolutely.
On this day outside, of course. Yeah, go ahead.
We are super excited at Falls Park. It's such a great location, and we want to make sure that we're really showcasing the diversity that is here in our city. So we've got an entertainment stage. We have Native American hoop dancers, a reggae band, an Andean fusion band, Ecuador Manta. We've got some new people coming this year. We've got some a Congolese Afrocentric band and showcase. We've got some Zumba from Peru. So we're really excited. And again, as Nishat had mentioned, we're excited for our workshops, which is something brand new in 2021, where you can go to a workshop and you can really interact and engage and learn about another culture, whether it's learning how to do a henna tattoo or learning Irish dance steps or even Native American beadwork. We also have some soccer and some Zumba workshops. So we're really excited to let people really dive into the cultures that are represented in our community.
So, Carla, this is for everyone. This is it's not just for people who have, recently immigrated to the community. It's for everyone to come explore and experience
for
the world. Yeah.
Yep, so that they can learn about other cultures and just come together to celebrate. It's a really great opportunity for everyone, no matter their background, to come together and celebrate, eat good food, learn some dance steps, listen to some great music.
Yeah. Tasneem, as you work with the as interpreting services coordinator, and you mentioned the difficulty of this past year, what are some of the things that you found that gave you, you know, optimism and hope as far as people coming together and supporting each other cross-culturally?
It was interesting. I would say the way how we could learn the diversity in town. When we jumped in with the project of getting all the materials available in every languages available for the community in town, whether it be the immigrant community who just got here. So that's when the interpreters jumping in really made us hope that it was a teamwork and everyone was just like making sure everyone got the right information, what was needed, because it was a difficult time. It was scary. We didn't know what was going on. I think a lot of times we were just trying to stay positive. So it was really good to see everyone coming together. So we had partners like Sanford, Avera, the city of Sioux Falls. So it's just overall getting everyone as a teamwork was really amazing to watch.
Yeah. Well, this is June 12th. I think most people from Sioux Falls at that area have a good awareness of what the Festival of Cultures is like and maybe missed it last year, but it is a huge outdoor festival and lots of excitement. Carla Thielbart, thank you so much for being here with us. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Nishat Tasneem, thank you as well.
Thank you so much, Laurie. It was nice talking to you.
We're going to talk a little bit now about the golden era of the zine when writers took culture and commentary into their own hands to create underground publications about topics they cared about, local bands, poetry, politics. Well, a new zine here in 2021 has a presence in print and online, and it looks to revitalize that tradition by inviting readers to celebrate the best music and musicians in South Dakota. It's called Tiger Meat, and it is the creation of Jonathan Bakken. The inaugural issue features artists like Jamie Lynn, Katie Dwyer, and Talon Bazil, all who have been Moment in Sound guests here on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Jonathan Bakken is with us now for a preview. Hey, Jonathan, how are you?
Hey, Laurie, I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
Tell me a little bit about your love for local music. Like, where did this, you know, why local music? Why not just music from all around the world?
Wonderful question. I make some local music. And so just like weird little music that I've posted on Bandcamp and stuff. And when I put out an album last year, at the end of the year, I kind of put my feelers out for like, who else put out albums this year? And I shot some emails and didn't hear much back. And one person wrote me back and they said, well, you know, last year with the pandemic, it was not really anything came out. And I was like, but I put out an album.
It got me thinking, what about me?
What about me? Or it kind of just got me thinking that maybe there could be a few more voices talking about all the cool stuff that's happening in our state, all the little weird corners, and also all the really big important things that I think, you know, I'm a music educator in the state, and I've been one for 10 years now, and I still really didn't know the big South Dakota names. I've only lived here for those 10 years. I grew up in the cities. But I just kind of wanted to know, who are those big names, who are the innovators, and who are those people filling in the weird little corners?
Yeah. And one of the things that you do is not only in, you know, at tigermeatmusic.com, you say, hey, if you know, you've made an album, let me know, tell me about it. But you also ask the people you feature in the zine to tell you what's on their South Dakota playlist. Tell me a little bit about that, because that provides this sort of connectivity, right?
Yes, it does, and it's my favorite part, and I didn't plan it. My first interview was with Bazil, and at the end, I was like, well, is there anybody else I should check out? And then he just rattled off, like, 8 or 9 completely gold albums, and I've been listening through him. He's got such cool tastes. But also, what's cool about that is I can listen to those, and now, hey, all of a sudden, I got some ideas for the next issue, so it's kind of just snowballed here. I'm just wrapping up issue 2. That's going to go off to the printer pretty soon and go into the snail mail off to the people who have subscribed on the summer solstice here at the end of June.
Nice. Well, that is a journalist's favorite question at the end of an interview, to say, who else should we be talking to?
Right?
So there you go. You kind of came upon it intuitively.
It's really fun, too. It's really fun, too, because then Talon went onto his social media and he like pumped all the things that he had shared. And he kind of said, you know, I've known these, but I've never just taken a second to think about who are my favorite artists of South Dakota. What are my essential albums from South Dakota? And so we had this big post where he, you know, really gave all these cool people shout outs. Kind of, I mean, he has people going back all the way to like Fool's Crow back in the 70s and Buddy Redbone in the 80s. Not only them, but, you know, all his buddies growing up. And that's the case for a lot of the people that I've been talking to, that, you know, everybody knows at least one great South Dakota musician, one great South Dakota album. And I'm just trying to kind of put it all into one place for people who are interested.
Yeah. So that speaks to something else that I think is really powerful about this, is there isn't really a canon anywhere collected, and this is sort of one way to you know, compile things. And as you look at the interviews, and you've got sources in the back of, you know, where you source some of these interviews you've done yourself, people who've been on shows like ours, you're putting in print these behind the scenes, you know, open up an artist's mind and ask them how they work, which I think is really valuable, not only for fans of the music, but for artists themselves.
Oh, thank you so much for saying that. And when I'm doing that as well, I'm thinking about, you know, I teach music. I teach fourth and fifth grade orchestra up here in Brookings. And I'm thinking about when my students get a bit older, that hopefully they'll find a little Tiger Meat zine, you know, laying around somewhere, and open it up and be excited, hopefully be inspired to just know that there's this whole pile of people who have been able to create in this state, and create great things, not just okay things, you know, just wonderful things. And also I'm trying to highlight all the different ways you can make music. I'm trying to not have too many of the same genres in each issue, just to show that, there's no one South Dakota way to make music, right? You could be an experimental flute player. You could be a native hip hop artist. You could be a kid in Lake Preston with a guitar.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
There's
no right way to do it. And hopefully it can light some fires in some other folks.
Yeah, it's a little bit of gold there. Here's my suggestion for you to look up the very little known and quirky Quartet Davis. So go find the Moment in Sound with the Quartet Davis, a string quartet of Oberlin grads with connections in South Dakota. They came playing in the studio, and I don't think anybody knows who they are. So let's give
Quartet
them a little.
Davis, D-A-V-I-S. String,
D-A-V-I-S, little string musicians. Great album that they just put out last year with really fun liner notes about what food and cheese you should eat while you listen to each song. And it's quirky, great, on tour, and worth knowing. All right, so you can go to tigermeatmusic.com. We'll put a link up on our website. Email John about your favorite musicians and subscribe to this magazine. It's $5, and you'll get it delivered to your door. I do love print, so thanks for doing it in print, John.
Oh, man, I had to. Yeah, thank you, Lori.
All right, thanks. We'll see you next time.
Yep.